and welcome to The Convex Conversation with me, broadcaster Helen Prospero. For the last few weeks, I've been totally immersed in C.J. Sansom's novels, featuring the cases of hunchback lawyer Matthew Shardlake. It's fiction, but set against the backdrop of King Henry VIII's brutal reign in the early 1500s. I've been missing stops on the tube, staying up late, having found a renewed fascination for history. And I've been equally gripped by Alice Loxton's lively posts on Instagram, where she brings to life bite-sized, intriguing historical facts and little-known stories from various periods in authentic settings. Alice is a 28-year-old historian, presenter, and author with more than 2 million followers on social media. Here she is with a fascinating tale from a church in the Cotswolds.
This is one of the most famous doors in Britain and possibly the inspiration for Lord of the Rings. It belongs to St. Edward's Church in Stow-in-the-Wold in Gloucestershire. The church was built in the 11th century with many later additions. This is the north porch of the church, and when it was built about 300 years ago, young yew saplings were also planted either side. But over the years, these trees have grown to appear as part of the architecture. So it's no surprise that this is rumoured to have sparked Tolkien's inspiration for the Doors of Durin, the West Gate of Moria, which leads into the dwarf world in the Fellowship of the Ring.
Indeed, Alice has packed a lot in, working with the National Trust, Downing Street, Sky Arts, Christie's, Sotheby's, and more. She's hosted documentaries on History Hit TV with Dan Snow, who calls his co-presenter the star of her generation, the next big thing in history. Praise indeed. Alice is passionate about bringing history to mainstream younger audiences, and I'm delighted to have her on this week's podcast because, Alice, I've got to tell you, you are my guilty secret. I'm addicted to your posts.
I'm so sorry.
Don't apologize. You've really just brought history to life for me again in such a simple and fascinating way. Tell us about these posts that you do, which seemingly will feel like they're almost daily.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the impression I hope to give across, at least, that I'm always out and about, which I am in many ways. But it's been great fun. You know, I've been on this real adventure making all of these videos. It's really boomed on Instagram. And it really started, I just was posting about locations that I found really interesting. So churches and cathedrals. And amazingly, there are millions of people out there who also find it incredibly interesting. And so it's been this journey of discovery for myself, learning about history, but also I feel like I've been joined by all these other enthusiasts and we've been discovering these places together. So it's been really great fun.
How do you come up with such gems and decide where you're going to go? Because you don't just go to somewhere that's really famous and obvious. If you are somewhere that's really famous, you come up with little known stories.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting the way it works. Honestly, there's not really a rhyme or reason to it. What will happen is I will contact the marketing team of somewhere like the Tower of London, and they're always incredibly kind and warm and welcoming. I won't really plan what to talk about until I get to the location. And then I really just have this system of looking at something and thinking, that's interesting. And then I think, am I that interested by it? Do I actually find it that gripping? And then I just think either no or yes, and then I'll make a video about it. So it's not really thought through more than that. Because I think sometimes in the guidebooks, there's this big story, but actually I just don't feel like it's that interesting somehow. So I don't know, it's just my natural eye for what genuinely interests me. And I think that's a good measure for whether it will interest other people. I think the thing that people really like are tombs, cathedral tombs, people are really, really intrigued by. But it's also all of those kind of secret hidden details that people are very familiar with, but perhaps they don't know that the amazing history behind them. So for example, there are lots of bollards in London, which they are shaped in that way because of the cannons that were originally there that were originally used. Or there's certain windows or brickwork that is shaped in that way for a particular reason. And people probably have no idea. And I think they really like the story because then they can go out into the world and then they can see this history and identify it for themselves. So it's really fun.
I think once you've started following you and heard some of your stories, you start looking out for things yourself. You say that then people like tombs and things like that. I don't think you get better examples than at the Temple Church, which I saw on your Instagram recently, and I went to a charity carol service there.
Oh, yeah.
And saw the tombs of, I think it's the Knights Templar, isn't it?
Yeah.
There? But left thinking, well, I sang a few carols, but I don't really know anything about them, and I just wanted to delve in. And that's a fascinating place for you, isn't it, the Temple Church?
Yeah, Temple Church is an amazing place. I've filmed there quite a few times now. And it's got this just incredible history. So it was the HQ of the Knights Templar, which is basically this group of crusading knights. And people probably know about it because of the Da Vinci Code. It's all to do with that sort of thing. But it's also really important in the story of Magna Carta. And it's in the heart of this area where the law courts are. So it's kind of got that really important legal status too. And every single church you go to pretty much have 800 years worth of history. And that's what's so remarkable about this country and other countries too. But, you know, in Britain, we are so lucky that we have these amazing historic buildings. And I can go into any single church and I know there's an amazing story there because it's 800 years worth, you know, and Temple Church is no exception. So it's got the Knights Templar. It was then, you know, developed over the years in all these different ways. The most dramatic part was probably during the Blitz. It was completely kind of wiped out. So what you see today is pretty new, actually. But with very careful restoration and everything, it's been sympathetically historically restored. I mean, did you realise it was most of it new, that building? Or
no, you see, I didn't. I was trying to remember bits and pieces from the Da Vinci Code that were sort of bringing it to life. I also did a big faux pas at that service. I was right in the middle of the choir. And you know when at the beginning they come in and they sing Once in Royal David City, oh, yeah, and it's solo and then everybody joins in? Well, the choir sang, so I sang too, and I don't have a very good voice. And I wondered why one or two of the choir members were looking at me in a strange fashion. And then I realized that actually it was supposed to be just the choir. that's my abiding memory of the temple.
That's
and also
really
my son auditioned for the Chapel Royal and actually got very close to getting in. And one of his auditions was at the temple. So it feels a very special church to
that's
me.
That's really funny.
But I mentioned C.J. Sansom's novels. I don't know whether you've ever read them, but there are seven and they're really thick and I'm not a big reader and I cannot put the things down. And they're set all in that area because it's the legal world in Henry VIII's time. And I think I've loved the Tower of London since I was a little girl and I've got those embarrassing pictures of me with beef eaters and things. When you go there, what are your favourite bits of that? And is that one of your favourite historical sites in Britain, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the Tower of London is absolutely epic. And every time I go back, I find it incredibly exciting. And I have to go back for all sorts of reasons all the time. But every single time, you know, it's just so wonderful. There is just so much history there and so much horrific history as well. I was at the chapel there the other day just for a Sunday service. And that's where they buried the people who've been executed on the Tower Green. So that's where they buried Anne Boleyn and people like Lady Jane Grey. And I mean, I still just find that incredibly moving to know that that happened. And I was reviewing a book recently all about young Elizabeth I and just being taken through the motions of Anne Boleyn being taken to the Tower, first of all, for her coronation, and then just not many months later, she was there for her execution and then she was executed. And the stories are just unbelievable. It's so hard to believe that these things really happened. And that's why the Tower is amazing, because you can actually go and walk in those footsteps and be in the very space where these things happened. I mean, we could talk about South London all day, but I think the space where Anne Boleyn's execution happened is obviously, I think probably most people are really gripped by that. But even the stories of the Prince of the Tower, the stories of the Tower during the wartime, how they looked after the crown jewels, the royal mint, the menagerie, you know, all the animals that they had around there. So it's just endless. I mean, all of these places, it's just endless, the kind of stories you could tell. So we're very lucky, as I say, you know, I think we're very lucky with the kind of richness and density of history that we have in this country.
We certainly are. You'll have to team up with my beef eater friend, Andy Merry, who I only met through the podcast, actually, but we've become great friends. I went to the Ceremony of the Keys, which I had no idea has been going on, I think, for around 700 years every night. So watch that. But what was lovely about talking to him is the chapel is actually his favourite part of the tower, and he's been there 10 years now. We were there quite late at night with my son, and we passed over where Anne Boleyn stepped through and went through to her execution, and he's like, oh yeah, Anne Boleyn stepped there when she came in for execution. But anyway, up this little staircase we went that isn't open to the public, and we saw a 12th century painting that they've managed to uncover. It's the crucifixion of Christ, but you can't see Christ on the cross because the Tudors built a fireplace over that bit of the painting. And they're not allowed, obviously, to remove the Tudor fireplace. So yeah, it just is teeming with incredible stories.
It is amazing. And that's what's so funny about history, is that it's full of these kind of human errors or human mistakes or things that we would just find so ridiculous. I suppose that's perhaps what I try to bring out in what I talk about on Instagram, is just trying to make this kind of, you know, bring that to life. That once upon a time, there was some builder in the Tudor period who was thinking, all right, so this is all painting, and look, that's where the fireplace needs to go. And, you know, they would have had that conversation, like, where's the fireplace going to go? And, oh, that doesn't matter, that old painting, and we'll just put it there anyway, or bringing in the engineer or something like that. Then suddenly it becomes this kind of lively event that you can kind of imagine. So those are the kind of stories I like.
Well, we've talked about big places like the Temple and the Tower of London that we're all very familiar with, but I like it as well when you're somewhere unusual or somewhere that I would have just walked past and not realised. A little bit like the clip we used in the introduction, when you're in a church in the Cotswolds and you've got this magnificent story about the Tolkien doorway that normally you'd never have noticed. You'd have just walked past and thought, that's a pretty church. Do you enjoy those little gems where you find perhaps an item or a desk or a piece of something that tells a story that nobody would have really thought about unless you'd particularly highlighted it or you had a special interest in it?
Yes, definitely. I love the big stories. I love the places like the Tower of London. And I think it's great to tell those stories because so many people have actually been there. So it reaches out to a lot of people around the world. But what I find most exciting is being able to go to some really kind of obscure village or church, or find some really odd detail, like a fence post or something like that, and then shine a light on that. And I think why I like those kind of stories is because there is so much history across Britain. There is just an unbelievable amount of history to discover for free. Every single village has an amazing 800-year-old building, which is the church. And if you think it's 800 years old, you can go in for free. It was built by ordinary people. It's used by ordinary people. And I think we're very blasé about those buildings being there. And it's so exciting because actually there is so much history that people could discover on their doorstep. And that's why I like those kind of odd regional stories, because I guess I try to encourage people to see that history doesn't just have to be going to a big museum. You don't have to be in London. You don't have to be at an art gallery somewhere. And you don't have to pay the quite expensive price sometimes to go into whatever the attraction is. But actually, there is history on your doorstep, and there is history in every street in the country. There's history in every lane, in every field. There's a lot of history. And I just really like the idea that I'd be able to help people and help myself wherever you are in the country. If you're just walking along any lane, you know, bringing it to life and having and understanding the stories behind it. And hopefully that just makes people's day to day, as it does for myself, far more exciting and interesting. So I think some of the church stories are really cool. I mean, I'm a huge enthusiast for this stuff, but it is just incredible. Every single time I go into a church, I'm amazed at what I can find. And I'm confident every single church I go to, you could make a viral TikTok for sure.
I'm sure you could. If you went to Grimsby Minster, which is where I'm from, my 100-year-old grandfather, who's now not with us, but he went over the top at the Somme and I did a documentary with him. He was in his 90s and I retraced his footsteps in France. And we went and did some filming in what is now a Minster in Grimsby. And I'd gone in there for years and not noticed this wall of names in gold. And you know what I'm going to say, Alice, they were all brothers, uncles, nephews, and they were all the names of those who were lost in the Somme. And the person that was showing it to me was my grandfather, who when he died was the last surviving member of the Grimsby Chums. And I often watch now if I'm home and if I pop into the church, gosh, people don't really know that, but there's a wonderful part of Grimsby's history there and all these men who signed up as volunteers for Kitchener's army. And it's just there for the taking, but it needs somebody like you to bring that. Maybe you'll end up in Grimsby one day and tell that story.
Well, you know what, Helen, my big kind of anxiety that keeps me up at night is that I need to go and see all these places and I want to go make content about everywhere in Britain. Like, I just want to go everywhere, and I've only scratched the surface of what's out there. I've been to some of the best cathedrals, but actually I'm probably 5% through the cathedrals, And there's just so many places I haven't covered, which I'd love to cover, and I'd love to give a platform to. So yeah, I will definitely come to Grimsby. And people always give me loads of suggestions, and I'm like, I will definitely come, but it might take me 5 years.
Well, if it takes you 5 years, my mum will make you tea or something if you go to Grimsby, okay. Because she's still up there. Just going back to what you were saying about really history, I suppose, being there in plain sight, it's been so difficult to choose clips because I love all of your clips. But one of my favourites that you did on that front was a simple little known fact about some fairly unremarkable looking metal railings in London.
These may appear to be ordinary railings, but they are actually a vital part of London World War II story. They are the emergency stretchers used by air raid officers to carry wounded civilians during the Blitz. Thousands of stretchers were produced for the war effort. They were made from a single material, making them cheap to manufacture. The design too was straightforward, two poles flanking a stretch of wire mesh. This meant they were very easy to clean, particularly in the case of a gas attack.
So that's one of my most popular videos. People are always fascinated by that story. Again and again, people just seem to adore it. And I think the hook there is that it's this thing that people are incredibly familiar with, or, you know, they feel that they might have walked past those railings many times, and that actually there is this history there that's so tangible, that's so moving to think that those stretchers were used to save people during the Blitz. And it's one of my favorite stories too, for sure. There have been newspaper articles about me making that TikTok saying people are going mad on TikTok realizing this crazy story. So then the newspapers obviously think it's really interesting as well. It's not really anything to do with me. I'm just delivering the story, if you like. But people are obviously really interested by that kind of history that is hidden in plain sight. It's a classic thing of something that is so ordinary seeming, but actually has this remarkable history.
How have you grown that following, Alice, or has it just grown organically and amazed you as you've watched your numbers leap up?
Yeah, I mean, it's just organic. I just basically make lots of videos and put the time in and edit them and upload them every day. And there's one a day. And I think people often perceive with social media that it shouldn't take you that long. It should be like a side thing. But actually, I've spent a lot of time filming and editing, and it could have been a full-time job, I suppose, but I really love doing it. So it's always been something I do on the side, although now it's more part of what I do. But it's just consistency. It's just constantly going out there, constantly filming. And I think also I just really enjoy doing it. And I think with anyone who's successful on social media, if you're passionate about something or you're really into it, it shines through. And that's the key thing here, really.
Your passion really does shine through, which led me really nicely onto what I was going to ask you next, which is, where does your passion for history come from originally?
It's a good question. Everyone who is a historian always says the same answer, that they've always loved history since they were a child. And probably for me, it was going to the historic houses, going to the various locations that you can visit in the UK. But I think about this a lot. When I was younger, I read all the horrible history books, and I also loved historical dramas on TV. And I think people often dismiss TV as if it's not an important factor, but it definitely sparks people's imagination. Some of those films really brought history to life for me, and they brought the buildings to life. And actually, I was just asked to review a new film that's come out about the Baroque era, really. And what I wrote about it was that this is the great thing about historical dramas. They might not be accurate. In fact, they're definitely not accurate, but they do bring these buildings to life. You know, when you go and look at his stately home, it's very hard to imagine people actually living there, but that's what these kind of TV dramas, I think, help. And for me, they definitely spark some sort of inspiration, I think.
Were there any particular houses that you remember from when you were young that were ones that you felt really did inspire you or lead you on that course to become a historian?
I remember visiting the Houses of Parliament and Westminster Abbey when I was very young. And I remember seeing the tombs in Westminster Abbey of Elizabeth I and of Mary, Queen of Scots, and just being completely transfixed by it and just thinking it was the most exciting thing ever. And I remember going through the House of Parliament and finding that incredibly exciting as well, just to know that this is where everything had happened, this is where it's all taken place. And also that the history, even in Westminster Hall, is just such an incredible space. That's the oldest part of the building. That's where Charles I was tried. For anyone who likes history, I think those places just come alive as soon as you go there. And for me, it's just always been this naturally fascinating thing and very, very, very exciting.
Was it? Oh God, I hope I'm going to get this right, Alice. Was it Charles I's earring that you were holding the other day?
Oh yeah. Oh, that was my 2023 highlight, probably. So I was asked to the Harley Foundation, which is this wonderful free museum. So anyone can visit in Nottinghamshire. So lots of people have never heard of it. I'd never heard of it. And it's just a classic example of this absolute gem of a place you can visit. And it's got some really incredible, stellar historic objects, including, I really could not believe that I was holding it when I was holding it, the earring that King Charles I wore when he was executed. So he was actually wearing that earring. And somebody afterwards went and plucked the earring from his ear, and then it was given as a gift to various people, and then it's in this family's kind of collection, and so now it's in the foundation. But you can go and see it, and I was holding it and I was looking at it, and I'm actually wearing the same kind of earrings today, but it was just absolutely amazing to see that. And then there was also a toothpick he used, and there was also the cup that he had communion in, the last communion he had. You could hold that as well. Things like that, it just makes me so excited.
These undiscovered places are brilliant. Do you have a favourite period, or did you study a particular period when you were, you know, at university and everything?
I have written a book about the 18th century. It's called Uproar, and it's all about the satirists and the artists of the 18th century. And so that is an area of interest, and people often assume that that's my area, which I definitely am very interested in. But honestly, the more that I discover bits of history, the more that I become fascinated by them. I think often people are interested in particular parts of history because they happen to know about them. And that's what makes it interesting, in that perhaps you were taught about it at school. And sometimes because you just don't have the knowledge, it's harder to find it interesting. And basically, I realized this when I was working. I used to work at History Hit TV, and I used to have to research all of this very strange history that I would never have naturally read about myself. But you develop all of these new interests because you're forced to learn about it. So basically, I'd never like to say that I have an area, because I know that there's history out there that I don't know about yet, but I'll be interested in it for some reason soon. And I'm sure it's coming.
It's quite nice timing for us to be doing the podcast now, because Uproar is your debut novel, but it's just about to come out in paperback. Tell me a bit more about Uproar and what inspired you to write it, because I know it's been a massive success so far, hasn't it, the hardback version?
Yeah, Uproar, it's been great fun. So this is my first book. It's all about the satirists who lived in London during the Napoleonic period, basically. So around 1780 to 1810 sort of time. And in my opinion, they are the greatest artists in British history, or they are certainly some of them. And I was learning about them at university, and I was just shocked that I hadn't known more about them. Their names weren't household names. They weren't along the lines of Turner or Hogarth or people like that. Even more famous people, like, they should be alongside people like Jane Austen. They've got big, big legacies that people don't really recognize. At least the ordinary person who doesn't know that much about history wouldn't recognize. I was basically inspired to then write a book. So I do have this kind of agenda to bring back James Gilray and Thomas Rowlandson and kind of give them the credit that they deserve. And the credit that they deserve is that they created all of these amazing prints during this period, and they'd be displayed in the print shop windows, and they were just kind of satires on what was going on at the time, whether it was social or cultural or political, and the impact was massive. They would shape political events, they would shape fashions, they would force people to resign, they created the myth that Napoleon was a short man. That's not true. So that comes from these artists.
Does it?
But also, yeah, so, you know, that's the kind of impact that people like James Gilray had. They created this propaganda, which has basically shaped the entire way that we see Napoleon now, or lots of people perceive him. So they're very exciting. And the big thing about them is that they're incredibly surreal. Their art would sit happily with a Dali painting. If you were going to write a book about the British surrealism movement, if anyone's ever written that, I would say that you could have called the book that I've written The First Surrealist or something like that, because they're really surreal. I think that's what I like about them, in that you often think about the Georgian age as kind of Jane Austen drawing rooms, but actually it shows that they're much more colourful, it's much more weird and wacky. And you know how they always talk about Bridgerton as being, wow, it like shows how exciting the Georgian period was because they use all this dynamic kind of music and things. Well, actually, it was way crazier than that. It really was. The stories that you read about the Georgian London, you couldn't even put it into fiction because people would think it was too ridiculous. You know, it's stranger than fiction. I tried to bring that all together in this book, Uproar, and it's done very well and it's been really exciting. And yeah, the paperback's just come out. We've just done a Blackwell special edition, which has been really fun. It's got quotes in from TikTok followers. It's got extra content. And then the standard paperback's coming out mid-March. So
mid-March,
yeah, it's very exciting. And there is also discussion of, this is the first time I've said this, there has been various discussions about screenplays and things like that. So maybe we'll see something in the future.
Well, we'll watch this space. What about the title? The title is very attractive as well. Uproar just wants to make me. Well, I will get it because I like paperback much better than hardback.
Same.
It's in paperback. I like the feel of a paperback.
Yeah.
But the title draws people in as well. How hard did you have to think about that? And where does the title come from, really, Alice?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the title is so important because I did think, should I give this set of artists a name? Like, should I call them the Gilreyks, for example, like the pre-Raphaelites? Maybe that's what I should have done. But I think Uproar is just such a brilliant, it just so brilliantly encapsulates the spirit of the age, the spirit of these artists. And it's so important that it has an exclamation mark at the end because it was really loud and exciting and vibrant. And people would go and see the print in the print shop window, and there'd be these massive crowds of people fighting to see the new print. This was kind of like a social media of its day, in that it was this really quick way to respond to what was going on. And it literally caused uproar. It did actually cause uproar. So I think it's not just a bit of fun. It's actually historically very accurate.
You picked absolutely the right title for that. And it will definitely draw me in. And I know that you've got a second book, which is coming out later this year. And she says, giving a little plug on my like very small Instagram, is available for pre-order now. Yeah. The cover looks great. It's turquoise and gold. It's called 18. What's it about?
Yes, this is very exciting. So this is the second book. And it's all about people in the past when they were 18 years old. So we've gone for British people in the past when they're 18 years old. And really, I just wanted to focus in on young people. You know, we've had lots of books which focus in on women or different groups in society, but I felt like 18-year-olds and being 18, today we think this is such an important moment where we're technically becoming an adult. And I just thought it'd be interesting to dissect that from a historical point of view. And I think it's driven by the fact that you always read about people in history and you just can't believe that they have had such extraordinary lives by the time they're just 18 years old, by the time they're 12. Like, there are people in this book who have survived plague, have been in charge of Italy, have gone to the Arctic and fought polar bears. There are people who have changed the course of scientific understanding all before the age of 18. And I just wanted to to make that point, really, and celebrate that actually young people are capable of so much and they have so much to give. And that's proven by what's happened in history. So hopefully it's a very inspiring book.
And by way of a teaser, can you tell us about perhaps one of the characters you featured and what they managed to achieve by the time they were 18 or what their young life was looking like at that point?
Although I wanted to show lots of people who have achieved a lot, I also didn't want people to come away from it being really depressed that they haven't achieved anything.
That we haven't been to the Arctic by the time we were 18 and fought polar bears.
So there are some people in it who become very famous, but when they're 18, they have no idea what they're doing. So that's hopefully quite inspiring too. Or that they don't realise that in 6 years' time, this amazing event is going to happen to them, which will transform their lives, which they could have never planned for. So there is a great range. One person, for example, is Elizabeth I. When she was 18 years old, she had her mother had been executed. Her four stepmothers had died. Her father had died. She'd had this weird kind of sexual abuse from her stepfather. She'd been caught up in this big scandal where she had to fight to survive, you know, fighting for her life. And she's never really had any rootedness in terms of the fact that, you know, she'd always go through these different kind of mother figures who would look after her, but that they would change every 2 years. And her entire identity at the age of 18 must have been completely confused and uprooted. Her brother, Edward, was on the throne at that point, completely without kind of a strong foundation of who she was or a strong support base. Even the people who were her loved ones, her two half-siblings, Edward and Mary, were also people who were direct threats to what she stood for. And I always think, what would a therapist make of that today? They would think, well, look, we really need to go from the start here because there's a lot to unpack. And I think the interesting thing is that you can look at those early years and you can see things that she does later in her life and think, well, that's obvious actually when you focus in on what she had gone through from that very early stage. And I've just been reading this book called Young Elizabeth by Nicola Tallis, which basically examines this as well. And it's just a very compelling case that actually these younger years, although in history books, they do obviously cover them, but it's almost good to just isolate them explicitly. I found it a very useful kind of exercise to write the book. There's lots of interesting people. I mean, someone like Bede, the first one's Bede, the last one's Vivian Westwood. So it's quite a range. But Bede, who's like this guy who's being in a monastery in Anglo-Saxon England, he has this absolutely crazy upbringing in that he's sent to this monastery. And then when he's 12 years old, everyone in the monastery dies. Every single person dies apart from Bede and his teacher. And historians will just say that in one sentence. But I kept thinking about this. I was like, hang on, you have to break that down. Imagine if it was your school, visualize your school hall, all of those people. So there's like 400 people there or something. And imagine over 1 year, every single one of those dies. You probably have to carry out all the bodies of those people. You have to see them suffer and die. And then at the end of it, in that hall, it's just you and like the maths teacher, basically. That's all that's left. And he went through that when he was 12 years old. Like, that's just a really crazy experience. And I think, you know, he was obviously driven by faith. And what would you think coming out of that? You'd think, there's a reason that I'm here. You know, I have a reason to be on this earth and there's a reason that I survived. And then Bede goes on, he's absolutely prolific in doing lots of writing, making all these amazing books. He's this great historian. So it's like really interesting. I could talk about this all day. Honestly fascinating. And it's been really cool.
It sounds like it was a really cool journey for you to go on. And it's really clear. I was going to ask you why you feel strongly or passionate about bringing history to a mainstream audience. But I guess the answer sort of stares me in the face when I look at you just come to life with it.
Yes.
Fascinating stories, aren't they? Why would you not want to bring it to a more mainstream audience? Because history in my day, it was so stuffy. And the history teacher, I think a lot of it depends on who you're taught by at school as well.
Yeah.
Just did not really bring it to life for us.
Yeah. Well, people always say that to me. They always say, oh, I had a history teacher that I found so boring at school and I've been put off history for life. And I think people have this lens of history that it should either be something you like at school or it's something that you only enjoy because of a book or this quite serious thing or it can only be talked about by someone who's a kind of professor at Oxford. That's obviously great and true for lots of things. But as we've seen recently in so many different kind of podcasts that have come out and so many different ways of communicating information, there are all sorts of different ways that you can learn about history. The Rest Is History is a great example, that great podcast where it's by, or Dan Snow's podcast, you know, these people who are really good at talking about history, but it's just delivered in this new format. What I always try and say to these history groups or museums, things like that, is actually, I'm not really saying anything other than what's on the plaque or what you've already written in your guidebook, but you're just putting it on a channel which is accessible for a different age group. So TikTok or Instagram, that's all it is really. So it's not really reinventing the wheel, but I think people do need to keep up with the latest technology. And I wish that more professors were on TikTok, but they are obviously very busy doing professory things, which is probably a good thing.
I think as well as your content and locations, Alice, your style also is very attractive. You have an amazing looking collection of what looked to me like Chanel style skirts and jackets.
Oh,
and
thank you.
Colors and fun colors. I mean, presumably that's a passion of yours too, is it? Because visually you look fantastic.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say. It's really fun. I suddenly realized it's way more fun just to dress up like all the time and look smart. I do like doing that. There's also something to be said for on TikTok, say, you need to grab people's attention quickly. And almost people might mistake me for a fashion influencer or something like that. Maybe they come for that, but then they stay for the history. You know, on TikTok, you have to get people in the first 0.5 seconds. Otherwise, you've lost them. So it's pretty dog-eat-dog out there. But I think also it's about changing the perception of what a historian would be, of who talks about history, in that it doesn't have to be someone who wears an anorak. Anyone from any walk of life can talk about history, I think. You know, history is there for all of us. We all have access to this history in the same way. And I guess I've never seen anyone who wears like cool suits talking about encaustic tiles of Winchester Cathedral. And that's sort of why I did it. And I guess I also like it. The problem with lots of heritage sites is that they're not perceived as very cool. And I would not ever like to suggest that I am the cool person on TikTok and Instagram at all. In fact, I don't ever feel like that. But I guess just trying to change the image a bit.
It's such a cool image. I'm way too old to wear, skirts like that. But I love your style. I think
well, that's very kind of
beautiful.
You.
They're pretty and they're lovely and they just look great.
Well, that's kind.
You've also interviewed lots of historians about their work. Somebody who's on my list, if I can get him at some point, is Sir Don McCullen.
Oh, yeah.
I've been to exhibitions at the Tate and various exhibitions of his, extraordinarily moving and brave. His life's been at risk when he's captured some of those incredible war images. What was Sir Don like?
Oh, incredibly lovely and kind and just a lovely human being, actually. So I was interviewing him at the Chalk History Festival, which is this amazing festival that happens every year in Salisbury, in the Salisbury countryside, the rolling countryside of Salisbury. He was there and it was so low key in some ways because I think he'd just given a talk, but then they had this kind of historian speaker corner where it was just this open tent and anyone who's just wandering past could walk in. And I was just chatting to him for about 40 minutes. And it was like a really amazing moment actually, because it was almost this like really low key part of the festival, but it was really intimate. So lots of people come in and it's almost, we were just having this big conversation together. But yeah, it's a real honor to interview people like him, to share the stage with people like him, if you like. And afterwards, in the speaker's tent, everyone obviously knew who he was. And he came over to me and he was chatting loads and he was very generous and genuinely interested in people. And obviously, that's why he's done so well, because he photographs people. But he genuinely was incredibly nice, yeah.
And recording more modern day history. People in hundreds of years' time will look back and discuss some of the work that he photographed and what was going on at the time, I suppose. Also, the one that caught my eye was Philippa Langley, because I did read a lot about the search and the exhumation of Richard III. And I think Philippa was portrayed in the film, The Lost King, as well. Was she fascinating to talk to?
Yeah, she is amazing. I think she's literally such a cool figure. I just can't get over the fact she actually discovered Richard III's body. People have been trying to do that for 500 years and she just did it. And she was just this like mom from Edinburgh who just got really into it and she actually discovered the body. And I feel like she is often debated in the press by historians and I don't know. I feel like sometimes she gets really mean press sometimes. But you can't argue with the fact she discovered Richard III. And I think it's just incredible that she did that. It's like the biggest historical discovery of the century. And it's all to her and obviously some other people who helped her as well. It's just amazing, her story, and it's amazing her determination, her dedication. I love her. I think she's amazing.
I can't remember now how she did it, but I remember being slightly obsessed with the detail of it at the time because I just found it so fascinating. How did she find?
Well, she basically just got really into the story and she like became really obsessed with learning his story. She had this theory that he was buried in this particular place. You can watch the documentary where they're digging and they literally just start digging in this car park and she's standing there and then they just find him pretty much straight away. It's really incredible. I think she's just such a... I can't believe she found Richard III. That is just the biggest, most incredible achievement that anyone could ever have done. All these people writing history books and all of us are like making podcasts and, you know, making TikToks and stuff, but she actually just did something so incredible. And I'm just always in awe of that.
It's quite wonderful. Before I let you go, I was just going to mention the Enigma machine because we've got a little clip of you with that, which was one of my favorite examples of where you feature something. I love Charles I's earring, which I didn't really know about. And obviously I've heard of the Enigma machine, but let's just play a little TikTok clip of you there.
During the Second World War, this was one of the most important objects for German espionage. It is an Enigma machine, which, by codifying messages, allowed the Germans to send top secret information without it being intercepted by the enemy. The machine was originally developed by the Dutch to encode business communications and banking secrets, but the Germans bought the patent in 1923 for intelligence purposes and adapted it for use in war.
That's an amazing object. I absolutely loved holding it, feeling it. And it was all part of this project I did with Spyscape, which is this big spy museum in New York, where we were telling the history of the world through spy objects. So that machine was one of them. There was also Napoleon's briefcase that I was holding, a dispatch box from the Victorian period. There was this little button that would have been used if you were dropped in enemy territory. You could unscrew the top and it would have a compass inside. There were also notes from the Cambridge Five set. So the thing is, when you get asked to do things like this, it's such a privilege. I'm always just so grateful that I'm asked to be involved, and holding these objects is just so incredible. Every single time you hold a historic object, it's just this amazing connection to the past, and I just find it endlessly, endlessly exciting.
What's next, Alice? What's coming up?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure. There's so much going on all the time, and I'm always trying to think further ahead. I've got loads of book ideas, and this is quite an exciting one coming through. But I'd have to talk to my publisher and my agent.
and lots more Instagram and TikTok for us to enjoy.
One thing that I've thought about recently is I've really become quite obsessed and a little bit concerned with the church, the current situation of parish churches, in that they are the big, I think in a few years, a lot of parish churches will kind of fall into disrepair. I think they will basically not be in use. And I think in the future, they might be like, this was the point where the parish church was lost forever after 800 years. And I think I might make it my mission to really share as many of the parish churches as I can and go on a bit of a church crawl, if you like, to kind of combat that. So maybe churches is going to be my big kind of campaign.
We'll see. Yeah, that would be a good one. Marylebone Church, which is really, really beautiful and one of my favourites, has had tens and tens and tens of thousands spent on it. That's the problem, the upkeep of these churches.
Yeah, I know.
And I'm sure there's some fascinating history in that one, as all of them. It's been such a pleasure. I've loved talking to you today. I feel like I'm with my sort of hero from Instagram. No. My daughter would be all embarrassed going, oh God, you didn't message Alice on Instagram, did you? How embarrassing, Mom. But it's really lovely when you follow somebody and enjoy what they do. And then you get the, yes, I'll come and join you on the podcast.
Oh, well.
Thank you for doing it, Alice. I really, really appreciate that.
No, thank you so much for having me. It's been really, really fun. And it's so lovely to chat about all things history, as always.
As always. Well, you have been listening to historian Alice Loxton. Do follow her on socials at @history_Alice and check out her debut history book, Uproar, which is just about to come out in paperback. Download and subscribe to our series at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple and Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to yours. I'll leave you now with a clip of Alice in Manchester.
This is the beautiful Anita Street in Manchester. And although it looks pretty peaceful and idyllic today, when this was originally built, it was pretty groundbreaking. During the Industrial Revolution and the rapid industrialization of Manchester, there were lots of problems with overcrowding, lots of the living conditions were incredibly squalid and disease-ridden. But here, the houses were much improved because they had a toilet and a sink of their own. And so it was named Sanitary Street to celebrate this. But by the 1960s, this name was deemed to be a bit embarrassing. And so they removed three of the letters to give us Anita Street. Much more respectable.